Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. David Crawford, a key leader in clinical research in the disease, particularly with his activities in the Southwestern Oncology Group. And to begin, Dr. Crawford provided an overview of the recent history of investigation in this disease.
This is a very exciting era in prostate cancer, and I've been involved in prostate cancer for nearly 30 years and a lot of trials with the Southwest Oncology Group and other things. And I don't know that I've actually witnessed this variety of new agents that have come along, and they're all somewhat different. If we look at in the past year, we have a drug which is an immunotherapeutic, which was approved, and that's Cipollucel-T. We have a bone-protecting agent, which is completely different than bisphosphonates, and this is a RANK ligand inhibitor, and some very good studies that have been done with this drug in the area of preventing skeletal-related events, and also just recently looking at delaying bone mets in men. And then also we have something that is called a 1720 lyase inhibitor, which is abiraterone, which has gathered a lot of attention. And it goes back and kind of emphasizes what was known years ago, that testosterone still plays a role. And this goes way back to work Jack Geller did, looking at tissue levels of dihydrotestosterone. And so that drug has been approved. And then also a modern new chemotherapeutic drug, cabazitaxel, as second line. So we've gone from really not a lot in second line to some real excitement with some new drugs. And then right on the coattails of this, just within the last few weeks, another, again, completely different type of agent had a positive clinical trial, and that's called alpha-radin. And that's a alpha-emitting radiopharmaceutical. So the number of drugs we have has expanded. They're really not overlapping. They're not like five new chemotherapeutic drugs. They're different categories. And that presents a lot of excitement. And so the issue is now we've got these drugs. How do we sequence them? What are we going to do? So we can start out by talking about what I think is one of the more exciting drugs, and that is abiraterone. And what's happening, as you well know, going back to the 40s, that Huggins and Hodges did this work about lowering testosterone, and they saw some dramatic responses. About 15 years ago or so, we did the studies of adding an antiandrogen to the LHRH compounds and showing that, in fact, you improved outcome and by 4 months. People weren't very excited about that, but we kept saying, well, this has to do with testosterone and lowering it and blocking the adrenal androgens. And when you think about it, men who are failing androgen deprivation therapy, many times, 30 or 40% of the time, when you change up, you add an antiandrogen, you move something around, they get a response. And some of that was due to the fact that their testosterones weren't low enough. And what happened was these antiandrogens had some effect. We're actually switching to different LHRH agonists. And so the concept, well, testosterone, you ought to get it as low as you can. Orchiectomy gets down to 14 or 15 nanograms per deciliter. And what happened was people tried things like ketoconazole and aminoglutethamide and stuff that lowered testosterone and had some responses. But it was only when a more pure type of an agent, and these 1720 lyase inhibitors, was abiraterone, was studied that the hope went up. And we're seeing responses in men who were failing androgen deprivation therapy and even failing chemotherapy, which was kind of unheard of, by lowering testosterone. So testosterone's still the king. And now with some of these new agents like the 1720 lyase inhibitors, abiraterone, and there's more coming, we can improve survival rates and responses without even using chemotherapy.
What about using this strategy earlier than its current indication, essentially before chemo?
I know it's happened, but right now these drugs are being watched very carefully. Not only this drug, but also Cipollucel-T that they're utilized within the approval. I have heard of physicians writing letters to the carrier saying, I have a patient who really is not going to tolerate chemotherapy or is completely averse to it, and I want to use this drug. And I've heard of them getting approvals. That's the study that's ongoing right now, Neil, and so I think that that will come very shortly. What's going to be more interesting is the desire to use the drug even earlier than that in combination with other ways to lower testosterone. And I think that's going to happen.
So are you talking about LHRH agonist plus abiraterone?
Yes, those studies need to be done and are ongoing in some areas right now, earlier treatment.
So you also mentioned the new bone-targeted agent, denosumab. Can you talk about, first of all, what the difference is and how it works, how it's administered, and then we can get into a little bit of what we know about it clinically?
Well, we know that prostate cancer therapy and prostate cancer both has a double whammy effect on the bone. By lowering testosterone, we are lowering estrogen, and estrogen's bone protective. And so what happens is, just by hormone therapy in general, you're set up to get osteopenia and osteoporosis. And plenty of data on that. Matt Smith and others have shown that this leads to osteoporosis and increased risk of fractures and so forth. And then the other thing you have, prostate cancer likes to grow in bone. It's the most common target for the metastatic deposits. And what happens is, so you got these two things going against you. Vitamin D and calcium should be given, but once patients really are on hormone therapy and have bone mets, you're playing catch up and it just doesn't work a lot. So this has led to the study of bisphosphonates, and they're oral and they're IV, and the IV are more potent and the oral may not work so well in preventing skeletal-related events and also osteoporosis induced by hormone therapy. It's called cancer treatment-induced osteoporosis or fractures. And so the IVs are more potent, and the one that has been studied the most has been zoledronic acid. In the pivotal study in prostate cancer by Fred Syed years ago, it showed that the drug prevented skeletal-related events and fractures and things like that, need for radiation and surgery. And also, it's been used for osteoporosis. A once-a-year injection of zoledronic acid is marketed for osteoporosis in women as reclassed and so forth. So the bisphosphonates work basically by poisoning the osteoclast, which, as you well know, remodel the bone, and the osteoblast replace it. That's how it works. Now, there's also other ways to interfere, and one is through a messenger called RANK ligand, which can produce by the cells, and it's a remodeling thing that works on the osteoblastic clastic system. And what happens is that the tumor also can augment production of this. And so this leads to something called RANK ligand inhibitor. So if you block it with an antibody or something that binds to that, then RANK ligand can't do its job. And so this was a discovery, and three really pivotal trials that were done with this subcutaneous injection of what's called denosumab, an antibody. And the first one was prevention of osteoporosis. It worked. The second one was skeletal-related events, and not only prostate cancer, but others, and breast, and it worked. And third is delaying time to metastases in men who had principally biochemical failure and rapid doubling times, and it worked. And so now we have an agent that is different and new than the bisphosphonates. It was hoped that it would be devoid of some of the side effects of bisphosphonates, primarily ONJ, or osteonecrosis of the jaw, which can be pretty devastating in men with prostate cancer that get it. But in the studies, it didn't change that. However, it's well known with the use of zoledronic acid and others is that when you give these drugs, you have to monitor renal function. And most of the time, that's not an issue. And you have to adjust it. Whereas with denosumab, you don't. So now you have something that's not IV, because zoledronic acid is, it's sub-Q. And I can tell you, in our outpatient facility where our infusion suite is going till 8 or 9 at night, we don't have enough bays in the rooms to take care of all the people that we have. if you can bump somebody out that's getting an infusion and then you give an injection like this, it's appealing. And also not having to monitor the serum creatinine frequently is important.
One of the areas that's been kind of controversial, I think, is the issue of bone-targeted therapy and bone in general in patients who are getting androgen deprivation. What kind of risks do you see them for in terms of osteoporosis? And do you think that an intervention like zoledronic acid or denosumab, you mentioned Matt's study that actually showed a reduction in events in patients getting androgen deprivation bone events. What are your thoughts about this today outside a protocol setting?
I think there are two ways to look at that. One is the most common use of hormone therapy right now is with biochemical failure, PSA. You said PSA-only disease. And that, you know, based on some work I've done trying to, the calculations, probably is in excess of 60,000 men in the United States each year. So in excess of 60,000 men are going to have biochemical failure. It used to be that the minute that diagnosis was made, somebody got an LHRH compound or an antiandrogen. I think we've stepped back and looked at that, and we can say that from the seminal work of Pound when he was at Hopkins, Steve Friedland, who you know, when he was there looking at this data, that a biochemical failure is not always synonymous with death. And we've been able to kind of dissect out who is at risk, and that's people with rapid doubling times of their PSA. That's probably the biggest thing. Rapid doubling time I would define as less than a year, higher grade Gleason scores, and maybe earlier failures. And so some studies have been done to try to see what effect you'd have. The first one is, I don't think there's any question that when you use hormone therapy, you get osteopenia and porosis. So from that standpoint, it's probably worth considering it. Do you need to do it like, say, like zoledronic acid every month or denosumab every month? For that, the answer probably is no. The more intriguing question that you're building up to is, can you alter the bone environment such that the cancer cells find it unfriendly and they don't deposit there or they don't grow? You know, it's the fertile soil type of a thing that exists in bone for prostate and other cancers. And the study was actually, the concept of doing this was actually tried with zoledronic acid years ago. And so the study was men who were on hormone therapy or whatever had biochemical failure, let's give them zoledronic acid and see what happens. And unfortunately, the study was closed after a few years because there weren't enough events. Well, they learned that the reason there weren't enough events, you didn't pick the high-risk people with rapid doubling times. So that led Amgen to do their study, which I mentioned earlier, which involved using this drug earlier in the disease in patients at risk, and it was denosumab. And the patients who were at risk were those that had rapid doubling times. And that study did actually show that the drug delayed time to metastases, and it hasn't been published yet, so I'm not going to comment on exactly what the number of months are, but it exceeded 6 months or so. And so that's going to be a likely an indication.
It's amazing. You know, we've been hearing this question debated a lot in breast cancer for the last few years. I think it's still up in the air. In multiple myeloma, about a year ago, a paper came out actually shown a survival advantage with zoledronic acid compared to cladrenate, and it sounds like prostate cancer is going to be getting in that mix. What about alpha-radin? Can you talk a little bit about that and how it works and what's been reported?
So we're in bone. Let's talk about bone. Prostate likes to go to bone, and bone scans are one of the ways to look at the disease. It would be nice to be able to quantitate bone scans, but it's difficult. So they're basically, hey, we got metastatic disease based on bone scan. We tend to manage bone disease with hormone therapy. Hormone therapy tends to work, but people fail. There are people that can have one bone met that can be in misery, and there are men that have bone scans that are super scans, we call them, where it's all over the place and have no pain. I saw a patient like that this morning with a super scan and no pain. And over the years, what's happened is people that have painful mets and things like that have gotten radiation. And a long time ago, when I was first starting, and way before I started in urology, there was a drug called P32, which was a radioactive phosphorus that was used in men who were refractory to everything and writhing in pain with prostate cancer. It did work a little bit, but unfortunately wiped out their bone marrow and didn't catch on. So there was a kind of a hiatus for a number of years, and a couple of drugs came around that were interesting. One was strontium and the other one was samarium. And these drugs are bone-seeking radiopharmaceuticals that will go to the area of metastases and also normal bone and release radiation over a period of time, and you got some responses. And so there's a real interest in strontium. There was a cross-Canada study that was done, showed an advantage over spot radiation, weld radiation. Chris Logothetis at Anderson has incorporated radiopharmaceuticals with chemotherapy in the management of prostate cancer, and that's being studied. They were around, but they didn't catch on a lot because mainly, you know, I always heard, well, we don't want to wipe somebody's bone marrow out, and it certainly can be enough to do that. And then also the risk of second cancers with the drug if you used it earlier. So they've been around, but they've kind of gone to the back burner. Along comes a drug called alpha-radin, and alpha-radin is radium-223. It is an alpha particle emitter, so that means that the depth of penetration of the radiation from this is in the millimeter range. And so you can give this drug, and you're likely not going to have diffuse effects on the bone marrow. It behaves like calcium, so it travels like calcium, and where there's turnover, you will see this drug concentrate. And what they did was a study of alpha-radin, no alpha-radin in men in the phase 3 trial. And there was a placebo, and it was an international study, on men who were castrate resistant that had bone disease and on hormone therapy and then other therapies they were getting chemo and so forth. And the study was a reasonably large study, almost 1,000 patients in this study. And I was quite surprised. Lo and behold, when they had their first interim analysis, I mean, how often does this happen? The Data Safety and Monitoring Committee said, hey, let's stop this study because the overall survival rate was improved from 11 months, basically 11.2 to 14 months. And that was just in the study called the ALSIMPTA study, which is basically alpha-radin in symptomatic prostate cancer patients. So in the symptomatic, there's a lot more data going to come out of here about bone pain and quality of life and so forth and so on. So now we got another completely different type of approach. We talked about the 17/20 lyase inhibitors. We talked about the RANK ligand inhibitors, and now we have this, and so we have another approach to management of prostate cancer, which I think is going to be extremely important addition to our armamentarium, and I assume that this drug will be filed with the FDA and be approved very shortly.
So let's talk about another new agent. I want you to take a crack at explaining to me how this thing works, incidentally, Sipuleucel-T.
So immunotherapy of prostate cancer, you know, if you just kind of think about that way I grew up, and well, prostate cancer is not one of those immunological cancers. It's not like renal cell where you yank the kidney out and some people have a response, or in a melanomas and things like that. So people have tried things over the years with immunotherapy and prostate cancer and so forth. And so Sipuleucel-T is an interesting drug that works in the immunological mechanism in prostate cancer. And so what you do is we have these dendritic cells or androgen-presenting cells, and these are the ones that present the antigen and stimulate the immune system. We have some things that are unique to prostate cancer. We have acid phosphatase, and we have some other PSA and some other antigens that we could probably think about using. And so what's happened is that you get a person's, through apheresis, their antigen-presenting cells or dendritic cells, you hook that up with an immunoconjugate with acid phosphatase, and then you grow it up, and then you infuse it back in. And so it was decided that it would be 3 infusions 2 weeks apart. So the studies that were started with the Sipuleucel-T, and it's been called many different things over the years, were early and somewhat disappointing because everybody was focused on, hey, the PSA's got to go down, hey, the PSA's got to go down. Well, maybe it's related to Gleason score. And some of the earlier studies they did, they saw not much in the way of PSA activity. However, there was a hint of an improvement in survival rate. And that led to say, hey, maybe this thing is stabilizing the tumor, and we're not seeing huge drops in the PSA, but we're going to see survival rates. So then they embarked on a couple of trials, and with the endpoint being survival, and being done in various aspects of prostate cancer, but the one that got approval was hormone refractory prostate cancer just prior to chemotherapy, although some of the patients got chemotherapy in a trial. And then what happened was when they analyzed it, there was a 4-month survival benefit. And the drug is well tolerated. Fever and chills are probably the biggest thing that can occur. It's a little bit cumbersome to give because the patient has to go get pheresed. They have to come back in 2 weeks, and the product shelf life is only a few days. And it's also a very expensive treatment. I mean, we're looking at a lot of work to generate the infusion. And so this has been kind of a lot of political controversy, so to speak, or academic controversy, with an advisory board at first approving it, and then no, and then the FDA and saying, well, we got to do this trial, and challenging the cost and so forth recently. But now things are rolling. The drug has all the approval status. They have the centers for the production up and running other places other than New Jersey. And it's out there, and there's been an uptake in the drug. The patients are interested in it. A 4-month survival benefit in oncology is significant, as you well know. And some people, it's longer than that.
How do you think that this agent should be integrated into this whole sort of new cascade? The indication talks about asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic metastatic disease. Is that specifically where you think it should only be used right now?
No, I don't. But I can tell you that this drug is being watched under a magnifying glass, and you better be sure that with your third-party payers that you're using it as the label indicates, and I think that's important with all drugs, but we all know with oncology drugs we tend to vary somewhat. These were the studies, and this is where it's approved. And because it is expensive, and $90,000+, it's on the radar screen. Like a lot of therapies, as you well know, cancer is a collection of genetic changes. The longer it's around, the more genetic heterogeneity exists and the less responsive it is. And so an immunotherapy may tend to work better earlier. So I would see this drug being utilized for biochemical failures, high-risk patients. And in fact, it's being studied. There are lots of areas where it's going to be studied. The other thing that comes up with cipollucel T, you brought this up very early about prednisone. We use prednisone with abiraterone. We use prednisone with chemotherapy, with docetaxel. And so now what happens when somebody has just gotten cipollucel T and you're going to throw in some prednisone? What's that going to do to the immune system? Is that going to negate its effects? There's a lot of discussion going on about that right now.
So the last new agent I wanted to get your take on was cabazitaxel, a new taxane.
Cabazitaxel is kind of an analog of docetaxel. If I were thinking about designing a study in people that failed docetaxel, I would not probably pick an agent which has similarity. And I, like many, were shocked when the study with cabazitaxel in men who were docetaxel failures showed a several-month survival benefit. And albeit with more toxicity, but we have to remember these are people that were already treated with chemotherapy, so they're going to be more at risk of that, and to show a survival benefit.
What has your observation been in terms of tolerance of this agent compared to docetaxel, side effects, et cetera?
Well, it has, in the studies, more toxicity, and there were a number of deaths that occurred. I think it was 4 or 5. Most of those were in Europe. I think one was in North America. And the drug has more side effects. Some of it has to do with the heavily pretreated patients and the usual effects you're going to see on the hematopoietic system. And some of it has to do with the drug itself. As you can guess, the drug is going to be moved up and studied earlier, and I think that'll provide us some answers there. So now we've got something more exciting. We have not only abiraterone in that setting as positive, but we also have a chemotherapeutic agent, cabazitaxel. And so now we've gone from nothing at second line to a couple of drugs, and now we even have alpha-radiant joining in there. We'll probably have others. We didn't talk about MDV-3100, which is a super anti-androgen. So,
what about that?
Well, I've often said that the perfect drug to treat prostate cancer would be an anti-androgen that works. The ones that we work with and I work with earlier on, the flutamides, the biclutamides, the nilotinamides, were anti-androgens that have weak binding affinity, and that's why they were used in combination with something to lower testosterone, such as an LHRH compound. What happened with MDV-3100 has a very strong affinity for the receptor. It keeps the receptor bound so it doesn't translocate into the nucleus, and it may fit the category of what I would call a super anti-androgen, and it's an oral drug. So depending on what happens, the drug given, you can have perhaps an unbelievable response. And then people that are refractory. So whether this would complement abiraterone or replace abiraterone or other things remains to be seen. I think the other thing we have to be careful about is that orchiectomy lowers testosterone to like 14 nanograms per deciliter. I said that earlier. We don't know what the long-term effects might be of this testicular annihilation, so to speak, where we get testosterone levels down to zero, basically, or when we use mass spectrometry, rather, to measure testosterones, we can get down to the zero level. And what are the long-term effects of that? We talked earlier about moving abiraterone up earlier in the disease. Could we be creating some all sort of new syndrome like super bone fragility, anemia? I don't know. And these are things that will need to be watched. And then along the way, how do we put all these things together? Now we're going to have probably 5 new tricks in our bag here pretty soon. And how do we put all these together? And how do you sequence them? I mean, if you ask patients, what would you rather have, a pill or chemotherapy? I don't think it's going to be much of a question that the pill is that plays around with the androgen receptor or so forth. However, you're going to need to talk to them about, well, maybe there's advantage to having docetaxel and cabazitaxel before or whatever, or alternating. I don't know. And that's why there's going to be a lot of research. And maybe what we're going to be able to do, and this is a lot of our hopes, are with all these new drugs, we're going to be able to turn this into a chronic disease state and maybe go from one to another and maybe back to one. Time will tell.